This is Bernie Mills talking on the first radio source surveys and the log-in-log-s relationship. At the end of his talk, Scheuer showed this slide showing the King and Queen of Greece and Fred Hoyle and Martin Ryle standing next to each other.
Sidney Cambridge and Controversies in the 1950s, 15 to 1960s, the nature of radio sources and the role in cosmology. I think these things remain of interest because the roots of the controversies seem to lie much in differing philosophies of scientific research as they do in observational discrepancies. They also show clearly the influence of instrumental limitation of time on the beliefs of astronomers, and thus conveying the message to the new generation. The controversies have been discussed at length by Adrian Mulcahy. The controversies have been discussed by Adrian Mulcahy in their book, but there remains a great deal which can be said. Adrian Mulcahy aimed to give an objective account, and an outsider, they appear to have done within the British scene, where there's some objections to that. Here, what I want to do is to present briefly the Antipodean view, which is often very different, and possibly some unattached historian of science may be interested to perform the synthesis. I should say that this is the first occasion, looking back, that I have had the opportunity to present a coherent account of the Sydney outlook on source counting and cosmology, and so that therefore my talk might be a little more formal than the others, since I have to I have attempted to give a coherent account. Well, no. Nowadays, it's difficult probably to appreciate the abysmal ignorance of the nature of radio sources prevalent around 1950. But two types of instruments, interferometers and small-size single antennas. The interferometers gave interference patterns, the small antennas gave large-scale spread responses. So it appeared that the sky was populated by randomly distributed point sources, which produced the interferometer patterns, and a broad band of rather featureless emission concentrated to the plane of the galaxy. And this purely instrumental result seemed to correspond to the general appearance of the visible sky, and led to models comprising dark radio stars distributed through the galaxy, much like the visible stars. And the Cambridge group, under the leadership of Martin Ryle, strongly espoused this view. When realization that it was likely to be incorrect came early in 1950 when I put into operation at Badgerys Creek a three antenna interferometer. And the first slide shows a picture of one of the of the very small antenna, which was then a very large antenna, about 13 meters, and operating at 100 megahertz. And so we had three of those on the east-west line, separated by 20 lambda and 90 lambda. And by getting interference patterns at these two different spaces, the intention was to identify the central lobe of the wide-spaced system by measuring on the narrow-spaced system. In those days, lobe ambiguities were also known to be a problem. But, to my surprise, the point sources detected by the close pair of antennas often did not correspond to the point sources detected with the wide-spacing. And when this is so, the apparent flux densities on the close spacing were usually much more than on the wide spacing. And it appeared that we were taking sources of large angular size, and which were largely resolved at 90 lambda spacing, but only partially resolved at 20 lambda. And further indications that the angular, that the radio star hypothesis might be incorrect, came from identifications which Bolton had suggested for three nebulae, at least one of which was known to be extragalactic. And the strong source Cygnus A, I had suggested an identification with a faint distant galaxy, but this had been completely rejected by Minkowski. Now, this was my first essay in radio astronomy. But with more accurate positions with this three aerial interferometer, I was able to confirm Bolton's identifications and in fact show that the possibility of the Cygnus identification was much increased. I also showed that there were two major classes of radio source, those strongly concentrated to the plane, the storm sources, which I call the class one sources, and the sources, weaker sources, apparently randomly distributed over the sky. This latter class we knew included extragalactic members, as identified, and we knew some were of appreciable angular size. However, we could not determine whether this latter distributed class was composed entirely of galaxies, like those identified, whether it included some other class or identified of extragalactic source, or indeed whether it included a proportion of radio stars. What we did know was that the radio star hypothesis was getting pretty sick at that time. And I received my first intimation that the Cambridge group didn't necessarily accept our results, because the travelling members of the group, like Pawsey and Bolton, reported back that the radio star hypothesis was still there and alive and well at Cambridge. However, at some point there must have been a radical change, and I haven't been able to work out when, but I suspect it was when Barnard and Minkowski positively identified the Cygnus A galaxy, source Perseus A, and Cassiopeia A, on the basis of Cambridge positions rather than Sydney. Also, we had independent measurements of angular size, Cambridge, Sydney, and Jodrell Bank, of the brighter radio sources, and these were all resolved and showed not to be of stellar dimensions. And the next slide, I show the radio link interferometer I used at that time for measuring angular size. This was used in is the portable aerial, just 2 yardies, used in conjunction with the other aerial I showed before. And this was wheeled around the countryside and a radio link back to the central port. We were able to resolve Cygnus A, Cassiopeia A, Virgo A, and Centaurus A with this instrument, but not get any details about the distribution. Well, for some time after this, there was little contact between Sydney and Cambridge because we were both busy with new instrumentation. As a result of experience with our three antenna systems, my own efforts were directed towards a pencil beam aerial across. And the first paper on that, Malik Little, I wrote, it therefore seems desirable to rely mainly on the use of pencil beam aerials and high resolving power in the future work, and to reserve the use of interferometric measures for special applications. By contrast, the Cambridge group were constructing a large 4-aerial interferometer used for the 2C and 3C surveys. Our work was delayed somewhat because of the skepticism of the powers that be, who demanded that we demonstrate that the principle of Lacrosse was sound. And so it was first necessary to construct a pilot model and a small size before we could get the funding for a large use. And the next slide shows our first pilot model, which was merely 120 feet overall, very simple little cross, which in fact was used to detect the radiation from both ventilated clouds. That was its only astronomical result. But it did show that the principle worked, and we were able to carry out a lot of experiments so that when finally we built our second cross, it was a very reliable system. Meanwhile, because of this delay, we didn't get our final cross constructed until about late 1954, by which time the Cambridge 2C survey had been completed with the detection of nearly 2,000 radio sources. The Cambridge interferometer, I think we could have lights now. The Cambridge interferometer comprised four aerials on a range on a rectangle like that, with spacings of about 600 meters and 50 meters up. The cross consisted of a system like this, in which the airborne dimensions were 420 meters. The frequencies were very similar, 81 megahertz at Cambridge and 85 at Sydney. I better show you the slides, next slide now. This shows a picture of the Sydney Cross, the final one, 420 meters long, constructed at simple arrays. And the next slide shows a group of the people concerned at that time about 1955. This is Ken Hawkins, the technician. Alex Shane, who was working at low frequencies and died shortly after this. Bruce Lee, me, Kevin Sheridan, Alec Lepore, and an important Cambridge, Henry Gooseback, who was doing half of his thesis with us, and the other half was lecturing in Cambridge. I think that was all the slides I had. I don't think I've been able to collect quite as many other people. Now, my first realization that all was not well with the new Cambridge survey came with a letter from Fred Foyle. he was very worried. The results of counting sources catalogued in the survey, reported by Ryle, didn't fit with his ideas. Now, as you know, for a homogeneous distribution of sources, not too far away, the cumulative log n log s count has a slope of minus 1.5. Ryle reported a slope of minus 3, that's to say a great excess of very faint sources, and in use this result to argue that the sources were at a great cosmological distance and they were in an evolving universe. And this, of course, is what worried Hawkins. Although we had just begun observations of the cross at that time and couldn't provide any detailed results, it is clear from simple inspection of our records that the number of faint sources could not be anywhere near as large as reported by Ryle. The source count slope was much less steep than minus 3. So I replied to Boyle with this reassuring news. A preliminary account of our actual statistics was given in the 1955 Jodrell Bank Symposium on Radio Astronomy. And my first impressions have been confirmed that our counts of about 1,000 sources gave a slope slightly steeper than minus 1.5, but nowhere near as steep as the Cambridge counts. Well, correspondence between Horsey, me, and Ryle started at that stage in an attempt to resolve these discrepancies. In addition, Minkowski visited Sydney early in 56, and after thorough study of our results and discussions of their significance, went on to Cambridge and reported back on his general conclusions. And the conclusions were that there was little agreement between the sources catalogued at the two places, and the discordances arose at the level where the two seat counts began to show a steep slip. And I was able to show that this was also the level where confusion affects and the two seat catalogue became dominant. Well, so far, there had been a free interchange of opinions and observational results. The battle lines were now drawn, because Ryle published a popular account of the Cambridge results and the sweeping conclusions he drew from them in Scientific American. And it was generally felt in Sydney that we knew the 2C catalogue to be faulty, and we're reasonably certain that Ryle must know too. So we felt it was necessary to query the conclusions, and I sent a letter to the editor of Scientific American describing the discordances we found and giving reasons for them. And this letter was answered by Ryle. Both letters were published, and that was the end of any further cooperation. But our aim of publicising the uncertainties in the Ryle model was achieved, but in retrospect, it may have led to an easier resolution of our differences if, in fact, I had ignored the Ryle article. Well, a full account of our checking was given in a sample area, a paper I wrote at Slee, that was published in 57, and we summarised the results as follows. We have shown that in the sample area, which is included in the recent Cambridge catalogue of radio sources, there is a striking disagreement between the two catalogues. Reasons are advanced for supposing that the Cambridge survey is very seriously affected by instrumental effects, have a trivial influence on the Sydney results. We therefore conclude that discrepancies in the main reflect errors in the Cambridge catalogue, and accordingly deductions of cosmological interest derived from this analysis are without foundation. I have checked this part of this sample area using the recently published longer reference catalogue, and it would appear to support these conclusions. In other words, we can make sense of the Sydney catalogue, we can't make sense of the Cambridge 2C catalogue. I'll give details, published details of that event. Finally, the source counts we obtained were in agreement with our preliminary results. We obtained a slope of -1.8, with an error estimated as 0.1. In other words, a marginally significantly steeper slope than the 1.5 expected, but the instrumental effects of random noise and blending reduced the statistical significance. And we summarise as follows. We find only a small excess of faint sources, which when accounted for of instrumental effects, is found to be insignificant as far as any cosmological evidence is concerned. A real excess is possible, but that suggested by Ryle and Shorter is impossibly done. And note that we refer to an excess of faint sources, but the statistical uncertainty, of course, arises among the small numbers of strong sources. And the high flux density entry is uncertain, which I emphasize later. But this were all, and controversy would have had little significance. But there's another string to the Cambridge bow. The Cambridge interferometer had a very large collecting area, larger than ours, and a high signal-to-noise ratio, and was completely confusion-limited. An almost continuous interference pattern was obtained, and they correctly concluded that a statistical analysis of the envelope of the beating interference pattern should give information about the distribution of weak and distant sources. And these calculations were performed by Peter Scheuer, and this analysis also pointed to a large excess of faint sources. Well, we knew that this work had been done in Sydney, but had no details. We carried out similar but simplified analysis and applied it for our results, and we found evidence only for a cut-off in the population in which we attributed the results of redshift. I think I understand this result now, because our survey limits were below the levels where these types of discrepancies occur. Well, As the two survey became progressively undermined, the Cambridge group, of course, came to rely significantly on the PFD analysis, and appeared to believe that we didn't really understand its significance. Well, I think we did, but we had a different concept of what was in the sky, and felt that there could be a different interpretation. Now, we were worried about sources of large angular size. We were worried about clustering of sources. We knew that sources of large angular size existed, and we knew that, and we felt clustering could exist. And we knew that both these effects would have effects on the Cambridge PFD curve, like those actually observed. In addition, the question of background fluctuations, which hadn't been resolved at that time. And so that we felt the position was really quite complicated. We had no reason to doubt the validity of the Cambridge measurements, but we queried the usefulness of their simplified model. And to use Minkowski's apt description, we felt that this was low-grade information. Well, there were other discrepancies and controversies, including the extended sources. We found that there were a lot of high latitude extended sources which were resolved by our instrument. Cambridge found many fewer. And this caused further controversy. I think, however, that this has now been fairly well resolved, and it had a big effect on our own output there, and if I might quote from a paper I wrote at that time, "Thus, on present evidence, it would seem quite possible that individual radio galaxies should appear relatively frequently in physically related groups, two or more, and a close clustering of galaxies can create vast radio sources of large angular size. Well, we know with improved instrumentation that, in fact, multiple sources exist in clusters, but they're not very strong and not very significant. Also, cluster halos exist over here. If we'd known about double sources, we'd have certainly included them as one of the possibilities of the extended sources, but we didn't. A recent analysis I've made suggests that the majority of the extended sources were, in fact, chance blends, which were much more than I had then allowed for. It was not as easy to separate sources close together, and particularly in the presence of a large number of weak background sources. This means that our estimates of the possibility of chance blends were much too low. Some of them are large radio galaxies, many are double galaxies. I think only a few are likely to be sideways. And I think the logic of including them in our source counts to reduce instrumental effects has been quite justified, although I still don't know their effect on the Cambridge PFD analysis. Well, finally, the luminosity function, I'll just mention briefly. At about this time, late 1950, it seemed to me the only way of progressing was to actually derive a luminosity, radio luminosity function. Until we knew exactly what these sources were and how far away they were, we couldn't really do any cosmology. So I spent some time at Cambridge, at Caltech, where I used our results, the new Cambridge 3C results, and looked for identifications. Well, it was a very frustrating activity. We didn't have accurate enough positions. This was the basic trouble, and I was able to show that about half of our sources we detected could perhaps be accounted for by a luminosity function I found, but it was rather unsatisfactory, and I was concerned about the possibility that substantial numbers of quite normal-looking galaxies could be radio sources. There was no way then of finding out, and it required the new radio telescopes of the 60s and 70s straighten out that particular problem. Thus, my own work ended in this particular frustration about 1960. And for most of the next decade, I was involved in building a new instrument and forming a new radio astronomy team. By the time our results were coming in, most of these problems were resolved, at least qualitatively, by large numbers of stations, ordinary living galaxies, and unexpected new tasks. I think I'll conclude by just a brief comment. If we had only the source counts as they are known today, I don't think there would have been any violent controversy with the chemicals. They're not significantly different from the 1.5 slope to have generated the heat which went on in this controversy. The actual controversy was triggered by the 1600 or more of fictitious sources which were firmly listed in the 2C catalog. And the controversy eventually concerned only the degree to which the radio data stood alone and could be interpreted by simple models. And I think there's been a certain amount of support for both Cambridge and Sydney viewpoints in the subsequent development of the subject. And I think that perhaps I'd better stop at that stage.
I don't know whether it's a good or a bad thing that the lateness of the hour makes it necessary for us to take coffee immediately. In 90 minutes time.
That's the end of this side of the tape.